good afternoon, everybody. First of all, I'd just like to welcome you all to the second episode in the Mortgage Advice series of podcasts. My name is Gordon Reid, and I'm Business Development Manager here at the LIBF in the Financial Services team. Today, I'm joined by my esteemed LIBF colleagues, John Somerville, our Head of Financial Services. Welcome, John.
A big hello to you and the audience, Gordon. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thanks, John. And we've also got with us this afternoon, Adrian Crowley, subject lead in regulatory qualifications at the LIBF, 26 years in financial services, 18 years in learning and development, and trainer extraordinaire. Welcome, Adrian.
Good afternoon, Gordon. Thank you. And good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon. I tell you what, introductions don't come better than that, Adrian. I tell you, you are a lucky man this afternoon.
I'm honoured.
You've got to live up to it now for the next however long, Adrian. That's no pressure.
No.
So, welcome, gents. Today's podcast, we're going to focus on all things CMAP related. Really conscious that this is the time of year when many people will be thinking about starting out their learning journey and perhaps their journey to becoming a mortgage advisor in 2022. So we thought it was a great time to talk about CMAP and to think about how we can really help people who are going to undertake that study over the next few months. So if I kick off with an opening question, so really leading question here, what do you think the keys are to passing a qualification like CMAP? If I throw that open to either one of you want to take that question first?
Yeah, it thanks, Gordon. It's a good question, actually. You know, there's so much to that as well. You know, there's as much as it's a leading question, there's an enormous amount to take into account. One is think about your own experience with mortgages. You know, is it just that you've got mortgage experience of your own mortgage, or whether you've actually worked in the back office functions of a bank or building site or network, or you may have absolutely no experience whatsoever. And depending on what base you're coming from will really much depend on, you know, your angle of study, if you like, and what kind of things you bring into this. What I will say is that with CMAP, a lot of people think that they've got to do it in order, i.e. do CMAP 1 first and then do CMAP 2 and 3. You can go straight into CMAP 2. Would strongly suggest you do 3 straight afterwards and then maybe come back to 1 later. And the reason why we say that is because it picks up on the mortgage journey immediately in CMAP 2, and you won't have any detriment at all by not taking CMAP 1 first. CMAP 1 is very heavily into the regulation. So it is UKFR, financial regulation. And it's for the novice, it can be a difficult subject to grasp. But once you've grasp the mortgage side of it, actually it becomes a little bit easier. So I think that's possibly a good starting point. And certainly, you know, also speak to people in the industry as well. It's usually very helpful to get a grasp of actually what's happening on the shop floor, if you like, on the factory floor, get a really good impression of what's, you know, what it's all about. Sometimes the written text doesn't really do it justice, I guess, and it's nice to know what this actually means in real practice, you know, and then also employ the services of a great trainer. I think, Adrian, I'm going to plug you there, and then you're going to then come in, hopefully, and help me out with some of this. But if you are struggling, don't struggle on your own. Go and seek out some training. It is designed to be self-study, but really there's plenty of tutor support out there that you can employ the services of. Adrian, over to you, I think.
Okay, yeah. I'll add some context from a learning point of view to what you've said there, John. In terms of doing them in order, yeah, it's, you know, doing CMAP 2, somebody who may be brand new to industry is an ideal way to start. And it can build your confidence because it's focusing just on one core area, which is the mortgages. And the good news is there is no study text for CMAP 3. So you take the knowledge that you've learned in CMAP 2 and then apply it to customer situations in CMAP 3. As you rightly said, John, there's loads of support available out there. Obviously, the LIBF issue a study text, but through Brightspace, which is their online learning portal, you have access to questions across every single section that you can test your knowledge on what you've learned in that particular section. And throughout the text, there's always opportunities to apply the knowledge that you've learned. In terms of it, if you're starting out fresh, whether you're starting on UKFR or mortgages, which is CMAP 2, the key, like anything, is preparation. Okay, don't for 1 minute think you're going to get through, you know, 400 or 500 pages of study text in 4 weeks. Okay, and retain that knowledge. You need to prepare, and when I say prepare, it's just taking the elementary elements first, like looking at the syllabus and what the actual learning outcomes are before each topic, because that's where you're going to get the questions. Okay, so if it says explain inheritance tax relief, say in CMAP 1, that's what you need to be able to do, is explain them. It's not to say that you're going to get a complex inheritance tax calculation. So it's looking at those. And as you're studying, you might be doing, you know, topic 1 in CMAP 2. At the end of every topic, there are some self-assessment questions that are really vital for you to understand if you've taken in the information that you've just read. And it's like anything, you can't sit there for 4 hours and read a CMAP text and think you're going to retain the information. You know, spread your study time, you know, 45 minutes of reading, 15 minutes of testing, or 15 minute break, and then go back to the reading. Nobody's ever going to ask you for the textbook back. Okay, so if you like to be visual and highlight key points, etc., or make notes, and remember, if you read something and make notes on it, you've got about a 70% chance of retaining that information, which you will remember when it comes to the exam. And also remember, no one's expecting you to read the book, be a world expert, and then start presenting knowledge on mortgage advice. You just need to have that level of knowledge that you can provide suitable advice to a customer given certain circumstances. John alluded to external support, and you know, not everybody is, you know, suited to reading a book, and you can have all of the study text in digital form on Brightwave. And what I've had a few students do is utilize the reading apps now that are available, and that, you know, they might have an hour's train journey, or they might be in the car for a couple of hours, and utilizing software like that to actually read the study text to you can be really helpful. But, you know, reading, digesting, and maybe researching, and then testing your knowledge is the way to go.
And just thinking about that, Adrian, I'm right in saying that the LIBF do provide some really good tools to support that testing of the knowledge as well, don't we?
Yeah. On Brightspace, each of the examinations has questions for every single topic. And one thing to bear in mind is they're not structured like they will be in the exam. So you get a fair mix. And the way I describe it is the questions on the LIBF site are designed to make sure that you're learning. So you will have questions that will ask you, give you a list of 10 things and ask for some that are, you know, true and false, applicable to certain circumstances. Some will be straightforward, true or falses, and then you get your standard multiple choice. So you've got those available, and then you've got a series of revision videos that are available on the forum as well, and you can purchase specimen papers to complete. Now, the specimen papers are formatted exactly the way they will be in the exam. And for those who may be new to this, a lot of students just think it's CMAP 1 exam, CMAP 2 exam, CMAP 3 exam. But the exams are divided up into the units. So I'll just give you a quick overview of that. So UKFR, which is CMAP 1, consists of units 1 and 2. So you do 250 question exams. You have to get 70% in each of those exams. So you've got to get 35 out of 50 in each unit. CMAP 2, again, is 100 questions, multiple choice, but they're divided into units 3, 4, 5, and 6. Unit 3 is 25 questions. Unit 4 is 25 questions. Unit 5 is only 20 questions. And unit 6 is 30 questions. Again, it's a 70% pass mark in each of those. Now, that can be beneficial because if you were unsuccessful, say, in Unit 3, okay, you would only have to resit Unit 3. So you would do a 30-minute exam just on 25 questions on Unit 3. So that means you can really focus your study and your efforts just on the topics that are covered in Unit 3. And then finally, we have Unit 7, which is CMAP 3, which is 6 case studies, okay? But there's 10 linked questions to each of those case studies, okay? You don't have to score 70% in each case study. You just have to get 42 marks overall. Generally, you'll get 2 case studies for new borrowers, 2 case studies for existing borrowers, and 2 case studies for post-sale matters. So again, it's about applying your knowledge that you've picked up from CMAP 1 to straight into customer circumstances in those 3 core areas.
That's now, fantastic. Yeah, really good.
And specimen papers are available from the LIBF across all 3 exams.
Fab.
I was going to say it's worth noting on the specimen papers as well. I think that when you are learning, and Adrian's given you some great tips there, I think one of the fantastic tips is really understanding where the marks are. I think a lot of people really get that, not misled, but misunderstand the fact that that's how you go about planning and how you've got to get your marks spread across the whole qualification. But a really massive tip here is don't rely on the specimen papers as you're learning. The specimen papers are a test of your knowledge. So if you find that you are failing in an area, don't keep taking the same specimen paper over and over again. And we're not visual here. This is obviously a podcast, but I'm looking at Adrian's head shaking, shaking away, because we see this a lot with students. And you know, what happens is you keep taking the questions just to make sure that you can answer it, which is great. But actually, you may not get asked that question in your exam, because there's a whole huge bank of questions that will get asked. And these specimen questions are not designed to be repeated in the exam. So what you need to do is, if you get something wrong in a certain area, take that back to the study text, go back and relearn it, and just try and figure out where it is that your understanding is not quite accurate enough in order to answer the question. Also, a lot of technique goes into this. So multiple choice exam technique, loads of that. Go on, Gord.
To be honest, you really good point, because Adrian's been giving us some great study technique tips. And I was just thinking for myself, I was thinking, what about exam tips? You know, exam technique is really, really important as well. And you've just started on that, John.
So the first part of this is genuinely read the damn question. So we have so many students on a couple of fronts, really. They will think that the question they've been asked it wasn't in the study text. And if they've studied from the actual specimen papers, it's because that, you know, they've looked at it from that point of view rather than looking from the text itself. It is, everything that's in the exam is in the text, full stop. I can absolutely categorically guarantee that. So the other problem is that a lot of students will not read the question properly and also not read the answers properly. So what you're doing, and I've seen it so often, is that they'll, instead of reading all of the options, unless you are absolutely bob on, cast iron, know the answer when you've read a question, what tends to happen is somebody will say the answer in A and not read the other three and just answer A, if that makes sense as well. Read everything. You have got more than enough time to complete this exam. Our student feedback is almost categorically 90-95% of students would say they have more than enough time.
How long do you think the average student does spend on the exam? Two-hour exam for CMAT 1, for example.
To get through all of the questions in one go, on average, I would say most students can get through in an hour. Mm-hmm. And then the most cautious of student will go through it all over again, probably take another half hour to make sure they've got it right before they leave the exam room. And then the final bit, they'll spend 10 minutes hesitating on pressing the button to submit it.
Yeah. Yeah. If we had a group of 10 students here now and we asked them to sit a specimen mock paper, okay, and if, you know, let's for argument's sake, they all scored 80. From the 20 that they've got wrong, there was probably 3 that they didn't know the answer to. Okay, they're genuinely hard questions. 4 or 5, they've picked the wrong answer. The remainder is because they've not read the question. Okay, so that, as John is saying there, is top tip. And I'll give you another tip. Is when you're doing specimen papers, as John and Gord have alluded to, don't keep doing them again and again. But look at those questions and think, how could this question reappear in the exam? You're not going to get the same question in the exam. Mm-hmm. But think about how could this be reconstructed and appear in the exam. So if it says, you know, Jones received £8,000 in dividend and she's a basic rate taxpayer, what is the tax that would be payable if she is a basic rate taxpayer? Think then, okay, what calculation would I do if she'd been an additional rate taxpayer? Okay, because the question is very, very similar, but the rate changes from 7.5% to 38.1. It will be no surprise that both of those answers are options for you to take. So it's reading the question. What is it that the examiner's wanting me to do? But when you're doing specimen papers, think, okay, how could this be influenced? Another little tip in terms of reading the question, you might have a protection question and the examiner is asking what would protect somebody over the long term or the short term. Just that one word in the question, okay, changes the answer from one product to another, because some of you might not know this at the moment, but the only long term protection product in the market is income protection insurance. But you've got to pick up on that one word in a 2 or 3 line question. I think that is a key tip.
And that links to what John was saying about reading every single answer, because sometimes one of the answers could just have the word not in it, and that completely reverses the meaning of the answer.
Yeah, nothing's deliberate in the questions to be like double negative or, you know, none of that exists really. The main really tends to exist in when you're under pressure, the way you read a question.
Yeah.
So, you know, and sometimes actually, if you're reading something, and this is another, we're going to be full of top tips this afternoon, I think, guys, aren't we really?
That's the purpose.
But if you are staring at a question and it's just not becoming immediately obvious, mark it and move on, i.e. you can flag your question and think, right, okay, I'll come back to that later. Because once you've settled down into an exam and you get into a rhythm of answering the questions, you'll become more comfortable. And when you come back to it, it'll reveal itself. You've got a better chance of being able to read something once you've got it settled in your mind. But pressure does funny things to funny people in exams. And what you tend to find is that people don't breathe properly, so they don't get oxygen into their brains enough, and they just don't see the obvious sometimes, and they're looking for things that aren't there. But equally, sometimes they just don't see the obvious. They just don't really just feel that they're being, somebody's trying to trick them or catch them out. And that's not the case at all. That's what not what these questions are about. And you won't find that.
It's a really good point you make there, John, because what a lot of students don't realise is the resources that are available. Mm. The prime example being the LIBF tax table. Okay. As soon as you start your studies, the two most important things were, that, as I mentioned earlier, the syllabus and look at the learning outcome. The second thing you should be reading is your LIBF tax table. Okay. You might not find it the most riveting reading in the world. Okay. But that tax table could save you 2 hours of studying, because I speak to students and they're saying, oh, I spent 3 hours last night reading all of the stamp duty land.
Trying to memorize it, Adrian.
Yeah. And, you know, they might come to a revision course and I'll say, well, you didn't really need to do that, because you'll be given all of the stamp duty rates for England, Wales and Scotland in your tax tables. Okay. So the only thing you need to really understand is the tiering of the rates. You don't need to memorize what tax applies to what country, at what rates, what's the threshold, is there an allowance for first-time buyers. You don't need any of that, because it's all included for free in your LIBF tax table.
And the interesting thing there as well, it's funny really, you just sort of remind me of something that tends to crop up in the questions. It'll be, you know, first and foremost, you know, there's separate rules for Scotland, as we know, against the England, Wales, you know, regimes that are available within mortgage regulation. But some of the questions that you'll get, they'll state something at the very, very start and people skip over what the question is actually asking them. So, again, this is one of those sort of situations where, it will state, you know, you've got a husband and a wife who are buying a property in Wales. And immediately you'll think, is it trying to catch me out, or am I looking in the right regime or whatever? And actually it's pretty straightforward, really, you know, but you just got to understand where they're buying their house. And, you know, also understand, it'll say, you know, they're buying their house for £350,000. So immediately, nobody's trying to catch you out. Just remember, right, £350,000, I need to think where the tiering is for that. But just immediately what will happen is we do see students who will look at the wrong part of the table, or they'll look at the wrong tier for that particular customer. And it's very easy to get it wrong if you don't read the question and relate it to that tax table correctly.
Yeah, and the examiner, as you said there, John, is always fair. They won't say, you know, Jack and Jill are buying a house in Wrexham, and you think, is Wrexham just in England or just in Wales, etc. Yeah. You know, the examples that they give are quite clear. And as you say, it's noting that at the beginning. Is it Cardiff? Is it Manchester? Is it London? Is it Edinburgh? Okay. And that's the first thing to register, is what is the examiner actually asking? I suppose one other thing that might be worth a mention is if students elect to use the regulatory forum, is, if they do have any queries around, you know, if we look at CMAP 3, affordability calculations can be a little bit complex when we're looking at committed expenditure and allowances for children, etc. If a student has elected to have access to the regulatory forum, they can always post a query or a question or seek further understanding. And one of the LIBF SMEs will, respond to them and support them in that, particular area. And that can be across, you know, whether it's CMAP 1, CMAP 2, or CMAP 3. And a lot of students have found that service of value, especially if there was a particular area that they've struggled with.
Fab. So if I was to summarize those keys to passing CMAP in three bullet points from everything you guys have been saying, I think it would be, think about your study technique. Make sure that your exam technique is the best it can be. And don't be afraid to utilize the study tools and support that's out there. Yeah. So concentrate, study technique. And part of that is understanding your own learning styles and understanding what works best for you. So as Adrian said, for many people, for most people, that'll be about small chunks, but it could be in different mediums. Exam technique, really read the questions, understand what you're being asked, read all the possible answers, and then study tools again. Make use of what you need to support you. Do you think that's a fair summary, guys?
Definitely. And one of the tools that you mentioned there, Gordon, which I think is so often overlooked, is the study guide, as in, you know, just making sure that your study timetable is absolutely on the money. Planning your studies out. I know Adrian alluded to this earlier on, but there's a really good study planner online.
It's normally the first section on the Brightspace course website, isn't it? So again, I suppose it's that rather than being tempted when you open up the course website to go straight into the learning material itself, read all those chapters in advance about how to study and how to plan your time and that type
of thing. So important, those bits.
Yeah. If you said as a rule of thumb, you know, somebody new to industry, say we said that CMAP 1 was 80 hours of study, as an example. Okay, how are you going to fit that 80 hours in over the next 8 weeks or 10 weeks? Okay, if it's 10 weeks, it's 8 hours a week. Okay, so how are you going to do an hour each lunchtime, or you're going to do an hour each evening and then 8 to 11 on a Sunday morning? And then you've got to be realistic and stick with it.
One of the things to do, a lot of students probably aren't aware of this, that you can book your exam straight away. Don't hesitate, just book a date. So think of your study planner, think how you know, realistic you're going to be sticking and rigidly studying for, and then at the time when you should be booking your exam, just book it now. Don't worry that if you do get behind, you can push it back, you can move it. But we find that students that plan ahead, book it in, they've got a target to achieve, they've got a target to aim for. But don't put yourself in a position where you're rushing your study. If you feel that you are getting behind, push it back. But do have that target in mind, because I think one of the most important things to do.
Yeah, you're right. And you can push that back at 48 hours notice.
Oh, it is 48 hours. Yeah.
But don't stick your head in the sand if you're starting to get behind, if that makes sense. You know, share it, because it's not unusual. Believe it or not, you're not the only student, if that makes sense. And we see this, you know, countless times where students will have a little bit of struggle, a little bit, you know, life happens and things just get in the way. You know, with the best one in the world, we've got, you know, most people have a bit of time off over the festive period coming up at the moment. So they'll think, oh, you know, I'm going to study a few hours every day, but then, you know, somebody will come around for drinks if you're allowed, and, you know, what have you. You know, you just never know what's going to happen. You know, you might just enjoy the festivities a little bit too much. As we all will, and rightly so. It's been a tough year, and I think, you know, rightly so and deservedly so. So, you know, don't beat yourself up if you do get a little bit behind. It's important to note. And actually, speaking of exams, I mean, sorry, Gordon, I know you've got a bit of an agenda here, but speaking of exams, we've got two methods of examining these days. So you can go to a centre traditionally, but hopefully a lot of you that would have looked into this and are listening to this podcast today will know that actually there's something called remote invigilation as well. And there are two different techniques really to thinking about how you take your exam. Most people will be reasonably familiar with going into one of our Pearson View centres, sitting down and doing your exam and being invigilated by somebody in the room and that sort of thing. Using a foreign computer and you know, just literally, you know, answering the questions on the screen. But there's equally a huge number of things that you need to think about if you're going to take your exam at home. And that means isolating in a room away from everybody else. And that's nothing to do with COVID, but that's just isolating yourself in a room, not being disturbed. You must remember that you can't visit the loo in the middle of it. You're going to be observed all the way through. You'll be observed by two cameras, the one on your computer and one behind you from your phone. And you will be, you know, in a an interesting position, but we do find that students find remote invigilation, if they get it right, a relaxing experience because they haven't had to travel, they haven't had to find a car parking space, they haven't had to sit in a car park waiting to go into a room, they haven't had all that sort of exam stress. And so what I think I'll get onto here is whichever route you take, whether it's remote invigilation or whether it's through a centre, you want to remove as much of that exam stress as you possibly can. And I think we've all got tips around that sort of thing. But one of them is really genuinely, once you've sat down, make yourself comfortable. Remember to breathe, which is, I think, is people all just sort of, I know that sounds, of course we breathe to live, but it won't take enough breath in, you know, they're sort of almost so focused, they don't really look after themselves. And you need to be as relaxed as possible to allow your brain to think. If you are constantly thinking of other things and you're on edge, you won't get the best out of yourself. And I think that's the most important thing.
No. From personal experience, I sat one of the LIBF exams earlier on this year, and I opted to do it from home. And it was a pretty seamless experience. I didn't really book it until the day before. I booked it on a Saturday evening. I sat it Sunday morning.
And, dedicated.
It's my own PDP for this year. it was a really good experience. So I just had to lift the laptop up and move it around the room, just show there's no one else in the room. And then it just started, and I was totally unaware of the invigilator being there.
Fantastic. And presumably you passed.
I did.
By following your own techniques, tips for study and for the exam itself. Nice.
Yeah. Preparation.
Excellent. Thanks, gents. So I think, you know, in answering that initial question, my initial question around what are the keys to passing, I also was going to ask separately, what are the major challenges? But I actually think you've probably answered those as well. What are those major challenges? I don't think there's anything else there. So just like to just spend a few minutes exploring. So when I'm studying CMAP, what is it the qualification covers and what doesn't it cover in terms of, I'm looking to be a mortgage advisor of the future. So what is it not going to cover?
You must remember that CMAP is the level 3. Okay, so in terms of complexity, we can probably put it as a level around about an A level, a little bit below. What it's going to give you on UKFR is a good grounding in UK financial regulator and all of the regulators and how they work together. So things like FCA, PRA, the Financial Policy Committee, and the Monetary Policy Committee, and so forth. But it's also going to give you a high-level understanding of financial services per se and the common products. So you'll learn about taxation, you'll learn about unit trusts, you'll learn about endowments and protection policies, the various types of money markets, treasury bills, gilts, and all the other saving products that are available. A high level understanding of taxation and so forth. So if you imagine that's UKFR with the general legislation that's built in as well. So things like GDPR, okay, Data Protection Act 2018, money laundering requirements, complaint handling, financial services compensation scheme, etc. All of those are in UKFR. In CMAP 2, we're going to focus primarily on mortgages and the mortgage world. So not just your role as a mortgage advisor, but also all of the parties that are connected to that process. So we're going to be looking at the role of valuers and the different types of valuations. What do estate agents do? Who do they act on, you know, behalf of? We're going to look at the Mortgage Conduct of Business Rules, MCOB, because really that's what drives and gives us the rules and the processes that we need to follow on our end-to-end process of giving the most suitable advice. We're going to look at the different types of advisors. We're going to look at mortgage promotions. We're going to look at all the different types of mortgage products that are available out there. And we're going to look at all of the post-completion matters as well. So if people want a second charge or a bridging loan or a further advance or all of those. But we're also going to look at, you know, what happens when things go wrong, really. You know, if somebody's suffering, you know, a break in work or their income levels are impacted or they're changing from employed to self-employed, how might this impact? And then all the important elements that come around that, like affordability, vulnerability. And if we do need to take a property into possession, because you can't repossess something you've never possessed. If we take a property into possession, what are the processes of dealing with that? So we'll learn loads of knowledge around that. And then once we've got that knowledge from CMAP 1 and CMAP 2, we're going to then apply it to 6 customer scenarios and demonstrate to the examiner that we're giving suitable advice. But we're only looking at level 3, and you know there are areas that are a lot more complex. We'll know what a you know, consumer buy to let is and a business buy to let when we're doing CMAP 2, but then we're not going to start looking at circumstances where we might have a limited company with two directors who are married to each other and they're looking to you know use income from the business to purchase a buy to let that they want to own through a special purpose vehicle. We're not going to go to that level. The good news is if you do want to go to that level, you would then move and progress from CMAP to the CMAP diploma. Okay. And right. Then the CMAP diploma then starts looking at those specialist areas, such as I mentioned there. So
potentially brilliant for somebody who's been in the industry a little while and as you say, looking for that additional development to deal with those more complex.
Yeah, if you did CMAP, 5 years ago, say, and you're a broker or you're working in the industry and you think, well, I want to create a bit of a unique selling point for myself or my brokerage, you may decide to do something like the CMAP diploma, which will give you a real good grounding then in the less common areas, like I just gave there, or things like, you know, self-build or multiple property purchase and so forth. I always view you know, CMAP as, you know, building your really, really strong foundation of mortgage advice on the common areas. And then your CMAP diploma is driving your knowledge in your specialisms.
Fab. So very much focused there on the knowledge side of things. John, I'm just curious, you know, so what else, I suppose, does CMAP not cover? And perhaps less thinking about the knowledge.
A few things worth mentioning here. First of all, fantastic. Thanks for doing that little walkthrough, Adrian, because I think people really commonly sort of don't see the full picture when it comes to CMAP. They sort of see it in sections and what have you. UKFI, a lot of people are probably thinking, why on earth do I need to know about investments and pensions and taxation and all the rest of it? Well, the reality is, you know, you're not going to be given advice on these, but you need to recognize it and you need to understand that there are other people in the picture here. So that it's not going to teach you to be a financial advisor, this qualification. It'll give you a grounding as to what a financial advisor does. And if you come across somebody that needs that advice, you can't give it as a mortgage advisor. So that's what it can't, one of the things it can't give you. But what it can give you is the knowledge to say, I need to give an expert referral over to a colleague who is a financial advisor. I think that's so, so important. Don't leave your customers hanging. And you'll find this when you get in the field, when you're under pressure, it's so easy to say, well, you know, I only cover this. But actually, the top mortgage advisors will then hand over to colleagues who are professional handover, if you like, to colleagues who can do the extra bit. Equally, there are other realms that are worth noting here. First of all, protection. So we're talking about life insurance and critical illness and income protection that Adrian mentioned earlier on.
Now, there is no regulatory requirement for an exam for this, but CMAP does give you a good set of knowledge. However, we do have a protection qualification, Cert Pro, as well, separately, if you want to study that in a little bit more detail. And then equally, if you want to give equity release advice in another growing area of the effectively the mortgage marketplace, then a separate exam is needed, which is the equity release qualification, or CIRA, Certificate in Regulated Equity Release. Another level 3 qualification, well worth studying if you want to move into that part of the market as well. So there's a huge amount to learn. Once you've done CMAP, it opens the doors to like huge, huge other areas. But of course, CMAP is the door opener. You then need to walk through it and then carry on studying. What I will say is if you've started that journey, keep going. There's no better time to start, continue studying than when you've actually started studying. A lot of people will stop and then not come back to it. And the longer you leave it till the next qualification that you do, the harder it is to get back into it, I would say. So worthwhile carrying that journey on. The other things that it doesn't give you, and this, and part of this is to do with life as a mortgage advisor. Once somebody sits you in a seat and says, right, you're now a mortgage advisor, off you go. And I think we'll all say this. It's kind of like, okay, what do I do now? And so, if you're joining a firm or if you're setting out on your own or whatever it is you're going to do, I'd highly recommend that you spend some time understanding what we would deem as advisor skills, what they would be. And that comes down to knowing how to interact with a customer, how to do proper, thorough fact-finding, asking the open questions that you need to ask, really digging deep into what a customer's needs are. One of the really biggest areas that I see mortgage advisors struggling with is that they believe they have to make a recommendation based on their own experience, and that's the wrong way of going about things. What you need to do is understand what a customer wants and make a recommendation based on what those customer needs are. And you'll get that from experience, you know, or watching other mortgage advisors, shadowing people, really getting that fundamental sort of understanding of what a mortgage advisor does. But, you know, so often is the case that words are put in customers' mouths or whatever, you know, you just need to fundamentally understand what a customer's needs are. So if a customer is not worried about interest rates going up, as an example, but you as a mortgage advisor think, you know, your own personal view is they will go up. It's not for you to impose that view on somebody. It's down to you to give them just the facts, the fundamentals of what you understand, because at the end of the day, none of us sit in the Bank of England on the Monetary Policy Committee.
I thought that was one of Adrian's roles.
To be fair to Adrian, it wouldn't surprise me if he suddenly, you know, mentioned one day, oh, actually, I do that. but yeah, you know, it's really down to fundamentally understanding what a customer's own needs are. And then, you know, giving them a good set of facts that really fit in with what the customer need really is, you know, and giving them choices at the end of the day. The other thing, you know, don't overlook protection, whatever you do. You know, the worst thing you could do to somebody is set them up on a house and a mortgage. And then if the worst happens, death or serious illness, and we've seen a lot of serious illness in the last few years, that they aren't able to work and then pay for that mortgage, and then they lose the house and repossessions happen. You know, and that can be prevented by some really good, solid mortgage advice. Anyway, I'll stop it.
I was just going to say there's a really good link there, John. So for those of you that are listening to this podcast, just to let you know that the podcast we're going to record in January is going to be specifically looking at some of the issues surrounding protection, not just related to the mortgage, but related wider than that for anyone who is taking out a mortgage and beyond. So just a heads up for next month, so to speak there. Yeah, I think you make an interesting point there, John. You know, what CMAP is not going to do is it's not going to give you that complex knowledge that Adrian was talking about. It's going to give you a great broad understanding of the financial marketplace, but it's also not going to give you the skills that will make you a really good mortgage advisor. And actually, do you know what? controversial. I don't think this is controversial, but I would recommend to anybody who's thinking about being a mortgage advisor, go and spend a bit of time with one. Go and understand what it's like to be a mortgage advisor before you even start studying for CMAP, because it's great having all the knowledge in the world and having actually passed your exam and having a qualification that says I can be a mortgage advisor. But if you're not going to enjoy the role, if the actual role itself, if the skill set that's required is not what floats your boat, then why are you studying it in the first place? And that's not me trying to turn people away from studying CMAP. It's from me saying, understand what the role's about before you do it.
Yeah, I agree there. And because it is, and we do some of this in CMAP too. It's a fine line. You probably noticed earlier I used the word suitability a couple of times, because that's the key thing. The recommendation has got to be suitable. But going back to your point about being a mortgage advisor, Gordon, it's a fine line in being able to address a customer's needs and objectives and meeting those objectives, and sometimes educating them away from what they think they wanted. Because our job as a mortgage advisor is to address the needs and objectives, not always pander to the wants.
Yep. Because their wants are sometimes too surface driven. They would, if they understood more about what they need, then they might change their views about what they actually want.
Yeah.
Let's remember what this is all about. You know, the people that you're going to be speaking to as a mortgage advisor have a really big wish list in mind. And that big wish list is their dream house. And, you know, once they're focused on that, they'll just hear what they want to hear. The skill of a mortgage advisor is to be really balanced throughout the process and not to be afraid of telling them something that they might not want to hear, i.e. things like you can't afford this, you know, which is, you know, unfortunately one of those things, you know, or, you know, I'll do my best and try and get you something, but then find that you're spending an inordinate amount of time trying to place a mortgage that is just practically impossible to do. You've got to be realistic. But it's so easy to get swept up in the want in this rather than the need.
And funnily enough, I used to challenge people who used to say to me that they wanted a mortgage, because I've never wanted a mortgage. I've had one probably two-thirds of my life. That was because I needed one. Or actually, did I need a mortgage, or did I need what the mortgage does for me?
I still don't want my mortgage.
I don't want my mortgage. If anybody wants my mortgage and they're prepared to take it over, I'm more than happy for them to have it.
Yeah.
Just can't have the house that goes with it.
The other one as well, and it's a really good point, actually, Goods, because I've done an awful lot of, I've trained a huge number of protection advisors in the past, and I've always said to them, nobody ever wakes up on a Monday morning thinking, you know something, I need to buy some term assurance today. It just never happens. You know, it's a case of understanding the need rather of you know, what it's going to do for them, not what the product is, or still the cost. If you just are selling on the cheapest product available, then you'll always struggle, because the clients are savvy these days. So if you say this is the cheapest, they'll see that as a challenge, go online and see if they can beat it. That's the key, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and it is sometimes quantifying that need. Prime example that I've used before is, you know, if I put a cash machine in the corner of somebody's lounge and I said, once a month, I'm allowing you to go up to that cash machine and withdraw £2,500 just once a month. But, you know, for the next 30 years, do you want to insure it? Okay. And most people will be there saying, yeah, I want to insure it. Now, you know, then you bring it back to the real life situation. Imagine that's you or your husband or your wife or your own income, and so forth, and it just brings it back you know to the real life situation. And
I always remember, you know, that these are old techniques, but they're still the good ones, where people will draw a house and that house is protected because you've got to do your builders and contents insurance, and you'll insure your cat who sits in your house, and you insure your telly which also sits in your house, and you'll insure, you know, all of your furniture because that sits
holiday in
your holiday. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you'll get travel insurance, won't you? You know, absolutely, 100%. But on the life of the person that supplies the money for all of that, there's no insurance.
Yeah.
Or no fiscal insurance or income protection insurance. And you think, well, okay, Why is that? Especially when, you know, actually, you know, I say don't go and lead on cost, but actually the cost of life assurance actually isn't, it's nowhere near what it used to be. I mean, I would remember cost of critical illness policies, as an example, 20 or 30 years ago, were unbelievably expensive.
For a 25-year-old female, 100,000 level term assurance over 25 years, you'd probably get change out of 20 pence a day.
Yeah. It's incredible. Yeah. And yet people go off to Costa and spend it. Or, other brands are available as well. But you know what I'm saying here. Go off to a your favourite coffee shop and spend £3.50 on a cappuccino every day. We used to talk in terms of pints of beer, didn't we? We don't do that anymore. It's got to be, it seems to be coffee these days, doesn't it? So,
speak for yourself.
In London, for a pint of beer, you've got to take a mortgage out for that. It's sort of in a circle, really, doesn't it?
It brings us very nicely back in the circle. And as I say, we could talk all afternoon about protection, but actually, that's what we're going to look at in January. So, gents, I think that's probably a really good point to bring us together, to bring us to the conclusion of this afternoon's discussion. So we've talked about some of the keys to passing CMAP, particularly around study technique, exam technique, and use of tools. We've talked about some of the challenges of studying CMAP. And we talked about what CMAP will give you in terms of knowledge, if you want to develop that knowledge, how you can develop it with other qualifications, but also perhaps some of the things it doesn't cover around that more complex stuff, but also around the skill set. So I think that's been a really good little chat there. And hopefully those of you listening have found it interesting, and some of you will find some really useful tips in there from Adrian and John, which you can use in your studies. If you do have any questions arising from the content of this, or you have any feedback, please send that through to us. We'd be really, really interested to hear, and really interested to get your feedback. So, going to bring it to an end. Thank you, John. Thank you, Adrian.
Pleasure.
Thanks for your time, Gordon.
No problem. And I look forward to recording episode 3 in mid-January. So we'll see you all again very soon. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to find out more about our qualifications, training, and upcoming events, then go to lrbf.ac.uk. We also have other podcast channels that dive into topics like trade finance, financial advice, fintech, and more. You can find all of them at lrbf.ac.uk/podcasts.